Support the Bartholomew Town Podcast by subscribing, rating, and reviewing on Apple Podcasts.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. On today's episode, I sit down with Common Cause Rhode Island's John Marion. John Marion is the executive director of Common Cause Rhode Island, a nonpartisan public interest organization that was founded in 1970 with a mission to, quote, promote representative democracy by ensuring open, ethical, accountable, effective government processes at local, state, and national levels by educating and mobilizing the citizens of Rhode Island. During our wide-ranging conversation, John and I discussed several pressing issues facing Rhode Islanders, including the consequences of an undercount in the 2020 census, modernizing the state's elections, and his assessment of change agents in the state's General Assembly. New episodes of the Bartholomew Town Podcast every Tuesday and Friday. Listen on your favorite app or visit bartholomewtown.com or ripodcast.com. It's where you'll find the dozens of conversations I've had with Rhode Island influencers like Providence Mayor Jorge Alorza, Lieutenant Governor Dan McKee, the Providence Journal's Alan Rosenberg, legendary investigative reporter Jim Terracani, a look at Rhode Island's future with Representative Mike Chippendale and Nico Lomazzo. It's all right there for you at BartholomewTown.com. It's been really fun to hear from some of you wonderful listeners out there. You can always reach me. I'm on Twitter at Bill Bartholomew, or send me an email, bill@BartholomewTown.com. Also, coming up on June 8th, I've been awarded a producer's grant for PVD Fest. I mentioned this on the previous episode with Mike Rea. Super excited to bring you a live podcast and variety show in the heart of downtown Providence this June. Stay tuned right here on the pod for more details, or follow on Instagram at pvd.fest and at Bartholomew Town Podcast. All right, let's go right to my conversation with Common Cause Rhode Island's John Marion.
The term I like to use is a good government group or a government reform group. We sometimes are called a watchdog group, but we actually don't do a ton of true watchdogging, right? So you've interviewed a lot of journalists who spend a lot of time digging through public records and stuff like that. We do less of that. We see ourselves more as putting the tools in place for people who want to do that, right? So I'm not spending a lot of my day making public records requests. I'm spending my day trying to make the public records law better. And so that's the reform part and less the watchdog part. There are times where we're a watchdog. I've filed complaints, public records complaints, open meetings complaints, ethics complaints, campaign finance complaints against all sorts of politicians and public officials. But that's sort of a side gig to the lobbying part for reform.
Yeah, so ultimately you're a lobbyist in a sense for good government.
Yeah. So some folks think lobbying is a dirty word, but right. I'm a public interest lobbyist, right? Yeah. So most lobbyists are there for narrow interests. So, you know, it might be Verizon's lobbyist trying to get a tax break for Verizon. I'm there to try to get, you know, a better ethics law that benefits everybody. It's in the public interest if we have a better ethics law or a better public records law. So I see myself as sort of a public interest advocate is the term of art that we use. But legally, I'm a lobbyist. I have a little badge. Don't have it on me today, but I have to wear a badge around the State House. And in fact, it was our idea years ago to make people wear badges. So if I forget to wear it, people, the real lobbyists, the corporate guys, like to point it out.
Yeah, they'll give you a jab for that.
Yeah, if I don't have it on. So I make sure I have it on whenever I'm in the building.
I didn't realize that was something that Common Cause had pushed, the identification badge, if you will, for lobbyists.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been behind a lot of the government reforms in the last 40, 50 years. So we're coming up on our 50th anniversary. But, you know, starting in the 70s with the Sunshine Laws and the initial campaign finance laws after Watergate, and then up through the 80s and a lot of stuff that came out of the State Constitutional Convention in the 80s, we were deeply involved in that. Through the 90s, with separation of powers and changing how judges were picked in the state, and then up to today, where we're working a lot on election reform and stuff like that.
Yeah, let's zoom out, I suppose. Do you feel like Rhode Island's elections are
free, open, totally the way they should be? Or what's the major problem that we need to address if they're not?
Yeah, so there's no platonic ideal for an election. You know, the U.S. Constitution gives states broad authority to run elections how they want to. And states have gone in all sorts of wild directions. So, you know, I've spent some time in Colorado. In Colorado, there really aren't polling places. Everybody gets a mail ballot in the mail, every single person in the state. And then they can drop them off at these huge vote centers. They love it out there because it's big, open area. They don't need to, you know, close down schools and have polling places. That's good fit for them. New England states tend to be more traditional. You know, Election Day is sort of a civic holiday, so to speak, and people like to go to their polling place. People's preferences are changing. So people like to vote early, and most states have sort of, even the mail ballot states like Colorado are letting people do it a little before Election Day. Rhode Island is just hidebound to, like, Election Day is Election Day, and that's when you vote, even though Rhode Islanders want to vote a little early. So we have been pushing for, 6 or 7 years now to try to get early voting, but it was the first part of a big package that we started in 2013 with, where we wanted to kind of modernize registration and modernize voting in sort of all aspects of elections, get new machines. So we've been looking at sort of making elections more modern for about the last 6 or 7 years. Not that we want to go to a whole different model of voting the way they did out west, but simply take what we have and make it a little more 21st century. So better machines, auditing those machines, making sure they're counting correctly, letting people vote early into those machines. So letting people register online, automatically registering people when they go to the DMV. So it's like this whole series of steps from registration through voting day, through the tabulation, the counting of the votes that we're trying to make more modern.
And of course, in Rhode Island, we already have emergency voting, which a lot of people would argue it's basically de facto early voting anyway. So why not clean that process up and formalize it into, you know, proper early voting? Then on the other side of as far as moving the primary, you know, if you move to August, there's arguments, well, now everyone's at the beach. It's really not that much earlier. And of course, in this state, if you tried to move it to May or June, you'd run into immediate opposition from the sitting General Assembly members. So what's the strategy that you think we should take to modernize elections now? Does it start with early voting more than anything else?
Yeah, I mean, so you mentioned, so we have these emergency mail ballots. Starting in 2011, they changed the law so that people could go into a city and town hall the 20 days before an election, and all they have to say is, I might not be able to be at my polling place on Election Day, and they can cast a ballot. But it's not real early voting, one, because it's not called that, it's still called an emergency mail ballot, and two, because they're voting a mail ballot, meaning it has to have two signatures or a notary on it. And that causes all sorts of problems. Some of them get thrown out because the signature has a problem and things like that. And it's created inequities in our system. One of the great things about Rhode Island and elections in Rhode Island, we don't have a lot of inequities like other states. So if you look at Florida, you look at historically African-American parts of the state that'll have super long lines compared to other parts of the state. That's true in a lot of states. We haven't historically had that. Poorer parts of Rhode Island have had the same voting system as richer parts of Rhode Island throughout its history. And that's been a great thing. But what's happened with this emergency mail ballots is some richer communities like Westerly have been able to sort of say, well, we'll open town hall all weekend and we'll invite everybody in. And so richer parts of Rhode Island are doing a better job in some instances than poorer parts of Rhode Island of offering these emergency mail ballots. So we want to just call them early voting so that everybody is on a level playing field. Everybody knows what it is. You don't have to sort of guess that you can use it. So that's part of it. The other part is just we're headed toward a tsunami, which is as people start using those more and more, As I said, they're a mail ballot that has to be processed. It's processed by seven people called the Rhode Island Board of Elections. They have to physically examine each one. We're looking at over 70,000 in 2020 that have to be hand processed. So if we don't switch to real early voting, we're going to face a situation where we probably won't have election results for a couple of days. And I think people are just going to explode when they don't know who Rhode Island voted for president until Thursday. So we really, really have to do this before 2020.
That's fascinating. All modernization. There's a lot of, you know, I listen to, the talk radio callers that will say, well, a lot of this is just rigging elections for Democrats, you know, whatever, whether it's early voting, emergency voting, advocating for early voting in Central Falls, whatever it is, there's that spin. I think that's a smaller voice than it may seem because it's a vocal voice. But how do you answer that block of criticism, if you will?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the Central Falls point, it's fascinating. So Central Falls advertised these emergency mail ballots as early voting, and they saw an 82% increase in people taking advantage of it. Westerly did the same. They saw 250% increase. Okay. So three times. Nobody is going on talk radio talking about how people are stealing votes and illegal voting is happening in Westerly. Okay. Westerly and Central Falls, almost an identical size, about 18,000 people. What's different? What's different? Central Falls is a community of immigrants. And so that's what I'm talking about. Like, we need to make it clear that every community is offering early voting so that we get away from accusations that this is all fraudulent. I'll also say sort of the modernization parts. It's actually, we're doing a ton to make voting more secure. So we're using electronic poll books, which are those iPads when you go in to vote. It used to be that there was a big paper book and little slips of paper would get misplaced. And at the end of the night, the number of ballots that had been cast would differ from the number of paper slips. And you'd kind of throw up your hands and say, oh, well, you know, some paper got lost. Now we have this electronic record with an audit trail. And we can see when people checked in. And so that modernization in many ways is making voting more secure, and we're able to more closely track who is voting and who is not voting. And so a lot of these steps are making it, I think, far more secure than it used to be. And there have been shenanigans in Rhode Island elections, particularly with mail ballots during the CNC era. And we're trying to minimize opportunities for that as much as possible while maintaining access, right? That's the balance. It's allowing legitimate voters to vote while making sure fraudulent election rigging can't happen. And so I think we're striking a pretty good balance in Rhode Island.
That's a great soundbite. You know, those dollars where you pull the string, we should just take that response that you just put together there as far as the Central Falls Westerly question. Or not Westerly question, the Central Falls criticism, and you'd be able to just pull a doll and have that recited every time that someone poses that, sort of xenophobic way of looking at things.
Yeah, no, it's nuts. When I started digging into the numbers, and I was just blown away because all you hear is Central Falls, Central Falls, Central Falls. And you never hear Westerly, and it was off the charts in Westerly. And, you know, nothing bad was happening in Westerly. What happened was they had a charter review commission. They had, I think, 40 local charter questions on the ballot. So the ballot was like 3 or 4 pages long. And they knew on election day that was going to lead the line. So they just encouraged people to come in and vote those emergency mail ballots early, right? So it was good sort of good election administration practices, and people took advantage of it. So there's nothing nefarious about it, just like there was nothing nefarious about what was happening in Central Falls. It's just, you know, the lens through which people look at it.
Yeah, no doubt about that. That's a much broader issue than just elections when it comes to Rhode Island and leveling the playing field, you know, in a meaningful way, is just getting that lens and just refocusing it for a lot of people. I think it's on both sides, but especially on those who would call a radio station and complain about Central Falls rigging elections for Democrats. So,
yeah. Now, you know, there are other checks people should know, you know, on the system. So we, Common Cause, was behind a law in 2017 that actually audits the elections after they happen. So Rhode Island's now only the second state in the country that actually takes a sample of ballots. Starting in 2020, we'll be the second state in the country that takes a sample of ballots and statistically judges whether or not the machines accurately counted the ballots, because, you know, there's suddenly these concerns that the hackers are getting into the machine. So we're taking a real proactive step on the back end to make sure that the ballots as marked by the voters are being counted by the machines accurately. So we're doing stuff from registration through the counting to sort of bring it more modern and make it more secure. So we've made real big strides in the last four or five years.
Who's the IT law enforcement agency with jurisdiction to maintain security of our elections? Or does the Board of Elections themselves kind of have some wing that, you know, Steve Erickson oversees somebody in an office that basically is just monitoring firewalls?
Yeah, so sort of the cybersecurity of elections is a real complicated topic, because at the top level, you have the federal government, right, in the Department of Homeland Security, which has, you know, some federal involvement in cybersecurity for elections. But as I said earlier, right, under the Constitution, states have this broad authority over elections. So some states don't even want Department of Homeland Security help. They argue it's a states' rights issue. So that's at the top level. It's the Department of Homeland Security and something called the Election Assistance Commission. But they can't come into your state. They have to ask permission to help. At the state level, it's a combination of folks. One is the Secretary of State's department, which has jurisdiction over the voter file, so the voter registration file. And we know from 2016, right, that the only systems that the Russians actually got into were voter files. They weren't getting into the vote counting machines. They were getting into voter files. And so that's under the Secretary of State's office. She has an IT team. Then the vote counting machines, that's under the Board of Elections. They're separate. And the Board of Elections does not have an IT staff. They rely on the State National Guard and the Department of Information Technology for the state, as well as the vendor. So Rhode Island, our voting system vendors, a company called ESNES out of Nebraska, they provide they manage the software that connects all those machines, and they provide most of the security as part of a, I think, 8 or 9 year contract they have with the state. So it's complicated, but there are many eyes sort of on election security in Rhode Island.
Yeah, I've always wondered that. Who's in charge? Who's monitoring that from the outside? It's fascinating to think that the National Guard and the depth and breadth of that process, you know, it's not just one guy in an office somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, in some ways, it's unfortunate that it's not one person in charge, because they don't have command and control over the system. So when there's a real threat, you know, you have things you have to coordinate. But on the other hand, you know, one of the reasons it would be really hard for a foreign government to ever flip an election in the United States is it's so decentralized, right? Every state uses different machines from different vendors, using different software. You can't just like hack into one file on one Amazon web server and flip an election in the United States, right? Elections are so decentralized that it actually makes them more secure in certain ways, which is kind of ironic when you think about it.
It really is, yeah. It works out. It's like a federalization of technology that benefits us in a lot of ways, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Other than, you know, the only downside is if you have states who are kind of bad actors or aren't doing their job, it makes, you know, it's the weakest link in the chain argument. It makes the whole system vulnerable. So Rhode Island's fortunate. We vote on paper. We've voted on paper ballots since 1997. And that's really the most secure form, right? You have this paper record that you can trace. But there are states, a bunch of states, that are still not voting on paper. They're voting on computers. In Georgia, Pennsylvania, and some counties in Ohio and elsewhere that are still voting on on what are called DRE machines, which are touch screens that don't produce a paper record. And those make us vulnerable because those systems are prone to error and can be more easily hacked than a paper record. So in some ways, sort of when you think about could a presidential election be hacked, well, maybe parts of it could be hacked, and that would cause a loss of faith in the entire system. So even though we're doing a good job here in Rhode Island, you know, if a big swing state is doing a bad job and people call into question the entire election result, a lot of our efforts here in Rhode Island are kind of all for naught because we just didn't, you know, those other states kind of let us down. So there is a, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
Right. And those are purple areas you just described. They're counties in Ohio, Pennsylvania, even Georgia. It's like, man, holy Moses, that's the last thing you need is for a breakdown to happen right there. I mean, if it happened in Hawaii or Rhode Island, you could almost, you know, move on as a voter, nationally speaking, I suppose, and say, all right, we're going to correct this. But boy, it would be like the hanging chad all over again.
Yeah, so we just don't want, you know, a digital hanging chad, right? We we don't want somebody going, man, there's some bad software in Georgia, and so we just don't know who won. Luckily, they're moving, right? So Georgia's moving to paper, Pennsylvania's moving to paper. So I think by 2020, by November 2020, almost every state, almost every jurisdiction is going to be voting on paper, which is much better. There's still some other issues that have to be solved, but you know, I think if every American has a chance to vote on a paper ballot, it's going to be really a huge kind of watershed moment.
I agree. In the last few minutes here, if we could look at one issue that sort of falls under your domain that broadly affects Rhode Island is the consolidation of power, particularly in the General Assembly.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, stepping back, we were very involved in separation of powers. So starting 25 years ago, Common Cause said, you know, listen, Rhode Island is still sort of operating under the Royal Charter, where we have a supreme branch of government. So from 94 to 2004, we drove the movement to put separation of powers in the state constitution, which we did successfully in 2004. And that, you know, strengthened the executive at the expense of the legislature by allowing the executive to make appointments to all these boards that execute the laws of the state. So the CRMC and Board of Education, and no longer could legislators sit on those. You know, now the governor appoints people who run those boards, and legislators aren't on them. But separation of powers didn't do anything about sort of the concentration of power within the assembly. So it weakened the assembly compared, if it's a zero-sum game, compared to the executive. But our assembly is still very top-heavy in terms of the legislative leadership controls the agenda more than it does in other states. So what we've done primarily on that is work on the rules of the House and the Senate. So there was this big fight earlier this year in the House, and then one after in the Senate, about how those chambers govern themselves. You know, they every 2 years after an election, they have to set their rules. And those rules are only good for those 2 years. And this time around, the so-called Reform Caucus came out with four proposals to make the rules more small-d democratic, to kind of flatten the hierarchy in the House of Representatives. And we supported that and tried to drum up some support for that among our members. And we got some changes in there, but not everything we were looking for. And then the Senate mysteriously sort of decided, well, this is a good year after it's all been in the news about the rules. This is a good year to do a big power grab. And they said, well, let's make our rules more like the House rules, which historically have been the Senate rules have been more open and better. And we kind of fought back a lot of that and won some concessions from the Senate, although their rules are worse now than they were 3 months ago. So our attack has been Less stay away from the Constitution, which is what we reformed in 2004 with separation of powers, and less work on the real sort of inside ball game, which is the House and Senate rules. And we'll just keep doing that. You know, every 2 years we have an opportunity to kind of make our voice heard on those and try to make those rules better. And we'll keep doing that.
Do you think an alliance of progressives, Republicans, independents, even progressive libertarians will ever form in this? Inside the General Assembly and possibly overtake the institutionalist Democrats that are in power? Do you think that could happen in the next 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, so I do think Rhode Island's headed for a realignment eventually, right? So, you know, starting in the 60s, a lot of states realigned where what were conservative Democrats joined the Republican Party, particularly in the South. And the religious right joined with the Republican Party, and Rhode Island never the Democratic Party never really realigned. And I think eventually in the next decade or two, you're going to see that realignment where the cultural conservative, and this is me kind of putting on my political scientist hat, not you know endorsing. We're a nonpartisan group. I'm not wishing for this. I just, as an observer, I think you're going to see that the cultural conservative Democrats probably no longer finding a home within the Democratic Party and maybe finding a home within the Republican Party. In the short term, I think there are opportunities for coalitions. You started to see that in the fight over the rules in the House. Ultimately, I think it there was a little too much sort of people saying I was here first, and they couldn't really align early enough. But you did see on the floor votes on the House rules, you saw the Republicans and the progressives sticking together. And, you know, that's a block of almost 30 votes. So depending on how, you know, the next couple elections turn out, that may be a block that's big enough to really force some change. The question is, once the reformers get some power, are they still willing to be reformers?
Right? Always,
so
right?
So a lot of people come in as reformers and leave as scoundrels. And so the hope is that if they come in as reformers, they stick to it and they make some reform.
You know, they know there's some major problems with going forward with that sort of consolidation.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting because this is the first time in a long time, you know, there have been speaker fights. And there will be two camps, but then sort of they all come together in the end, except for a few dissidents. This is the first time you have a real sort of large block of people in the House from the majority party who are sticking out there and saying, you know, we're going to be cohesive as a block. So it'll be very interesting how it plays out from that perspective and whether or not they're willing to form alliances as a block. I'm not sure. You know, when this rules fight was happening, you know, I think that group was kind of caucusing pretty regularly and trying to come to common positions. I'm not sure as the session has worn on, many of them are freshmen, you know, they've been quite as cohesive. But the next big thing this year, you know, is always the budget, which requires a supermajority vote. So whether or not, you know, they stick together on the budget and can try to get some concessions on that. It's going to be very, just as an observer, very interesting to see if they stick together.
Yeah, once we get the May estimated revenue, it'll be interesting to see where certain reps fall on pre-K and expansion of RI Promise and some of these things that, you know, will they move back towards the center, if you will, based on hard numbers, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things that's most remarkable to me is I'm in my 11th legislative session and I've never seen a good budget year, right? So this is as good as the economy's been in a couple decades, and we're still running a $200 million structural deficit with projections going out for it to get worse. So, you know, God help the state of Rhode Island when the next recession comes because you know, if they think they're making hard choices now, they're going to have to make real hard choices you know, if the recession comes and revenues, tax revenues fall off. So, yeah, it's fascinating. But which is actually today's April 1st.
Yep.
We're taping this, which is called Census Day. So a year from today is April 1st, 2020, which is the day, it's Census Day, right? That's the day when we're supposed to take the snapshot as a country of who is here.
Hmm.
And so this is 1 year out from that. One of the interesting things about the census is about $3 billion in federal money comes to Rhode Island, billion a year, based on census data. So to give some perspective, we're dealing with a $200 million with an M dollar budget deficit this year. And everybody's in a panic. Out of a $9 billion with a B dollar budget, $3 billion annually comes from federal dollars. So if we do a bad job counting people next year during the census, that's going to make that $200 million look small, right? So we've actually been thinking a lot about the census and what the implications are going to be for the budget because. If we have an undercount here, it's going to be just a fiscal disaster for the state. And you get one shot a decade, right? If we do a bad job next year, you don't get to try it in 2021 or 2022 again. You got to wait a whole decade. So these fiscal issues that look so bad in the moment would be magnified by a bad census.
Yeah, it's not only the congressional seat issue, which would be related to population, not only just not increasing at the pace that would be required to maintain it, but it's a money issue straight up. As far as the census, how do you engage in the census?
Yeah, so you know, the way to engage is just to answer it, right? So and to encourage people you know who are skeptical about answering it to answer it and to assure them that the census is confidential. Right, they cannot release individual census records for 70 years by federal law, and even if the FBI raids the census office, they can't take the census files. There is a law called Title 13 in federal law that prohibits the census from sharing that with any other part of the federal government. The individual level census files. So people just have to be assured that they should participate, and it's going to be private if they participate. And that there's a lot at stake for them and their communities, right? So you mentioned we might lose one of our two congressional seats and be down to one member of Congress for the first time since 1789, which is remarkable. But it's not just that. If you are living in Providence and Providence has a severe undercount, Providence will lose a lot of reps in the General Assembly, right? So it'll skew power within the state. In the state legislature, not just within Congress. So there's representation, there's money, you know, there's highway funds. You know, it's not just social service programs. You know, the amount of money we get for highways and other transportation projects is all derived from the census. So there's all sorts of stuff at stake. And it doesn't mean they stop taxing, right? It's not like they go, well,
yeah.
Rhode Island didn't have these people, so we're not going to tax those people. No, you still have to pay out, you know, pay your taxes to the IRS. Rhode Island just won't get the money, those tax monies in return back from the federal government. So there's a lot at stake for the state, but even for just individuals, you know, the programs people rely on, the roads people drive on are all based on the census.
Absolutely. And my message is that, you know, if you see scare tactics being portrayed, particularly those targeting English language learners who may or may not have, you know, documentation to live and work in the United States or whatever it is, you know, this sort of rhetoric, I think combating that is very important. It should be an apolitical issue, really. You know, we should have a clean census and it's not grounds for xenophobia. There's the word again.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of controversy around the citizenship question. What everybody has to realize is that the census has always counted everyone, citizen, non-citizen alike, right? It was a huge stain on the founding of the country, but in the first census, they counted slaves as 3/5 of a person.
Yep.
But they counted them, and they've counted non-citizens from the very beginning, from when Thomas Jefferson, you know, ran the first census as the first Secretary of State. He had to count everybody in the United States, regardless of whether they were citizens or not. So everybody needs to get counted. It's critically important. And there are all sorts of challenging populations that you don't think about. The most undercounted population is children 0 to 4, right? They can't fill out a form, right? And maybe they're living with their grandparents, and the grandparents think, well, they're not my child. I shouldn't count them in my household. But the parents don't count them in their household because they're not physically with them. We know that there's a huge undercount nationally. Millions of children 0 to 4 aren't being counted. But you know, and they can't speak for themselves. So we have to speak for them. And so that's why the census is just this sort of incredible challenge.
And that's a year out from now. We'll have to do a pod episode just right before the census comes out, heads up hockey as this thing hits the streets.
Yeah.
Do we do in Rhode Island? I wasn't here in 2010. I was in New York and the people knocked on the doors. Is that how it works here? You get someone coming around and.
Yeah, so the Census Bureau does what's called non-response follow-up. So basically, if you don't fill out the form, they knock on your door eventually.
Gotcha.
That in the census, it's the largest non-military operation of the federal government. They'll hire almost 500,000 people between now and next April to do that. It's just an enormous undertaking. But what we're trying to do in Rhode Island, that a lot of other states have done in the past, but Rhode Island's never done, not just wait for the census to come knocking, but as a community, reach out and try to encourage people through community groups to participate proactively, right? So New York, I think, put aside $20 or $40 million, something like that, for community groups to promote the census. California put aside $100 million to promote the census. Rhode Island, Governor Raimondo's budget has $150,000 in it. The Rhode Island Foundation just put in $250,000. We're trying to build a pot of about $1.2 million to fund community groups to encourage participation in the census because we can't just wait for the Census Bureau to come knock on our door, right? We have to be proactive in encouraging people to do it. And the Census Bureau has scaled back their efforts. They had 2 census offices in Rhode Island in 2010. They're only going to have 1 this time. They're moving the questionnaire online for the first time. So, in fact, most people are going to be asked not to fill out a paper form. They're going to be given a 9-digit code and told to go to a website. We don't even know how that's going to work. So,
yeah, or if that's hackable, right? Or what the kind of security questions around that.
The Census Bureau is terrified of fake websites and social media promoting fake census websites. So, you know, they had to make that decision years and years ago. That decision was made like 10 years ago. And now it's just like as we're coming to doing it, you're like, well, that might not have been the best idea to move it online. But it's not a decision that can be reversed at this point, so we've got to go forward with it. And Rhode Island's got to kind of step up and encourage participation.
Yeah, maybe that's the first use of blockchain in our government. You know, we'll be let it live there.
Yeah, we didn't even get into blockchain. Good thing we didn't on elections because there's some people trying to sell blockchain elections, and I'm not buying.
That sounds like a great discussion going into 2020. So
yeah.
John Marion, Common Cause, a real pleasure to have you on the program. I definitely follow your work and really appreciate what you're doing, trying to open it up for us here to make things happen in this place, this beautiful state that we're trying to rebuild in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, frankly. Yeah, no. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on your podcast. And thanks, you know, for bringing a lot of voices to the table who some of whom, you know, we're not all hearing from, and some of whom we're very familiar with, but we're used to just having sound bites from. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. That's all the time we have for today, but I'll be back next week with brand new content. Until then, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits. And 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.